You are listening to the Buckeye Visualist.
Welcome to the Buckeye Visualist, a podcast for members of the Ohio News Photographers Association, which aims to support professional and student visual storytellers throughout Buckeye Land and beyond. For this episode, we are going to focus on freelancing, filmmaking, and having a business sense, which you absolutely need to survive in this oversaturated, unstable world we visual storytellers work in today. It is my pleasure to welcome my next guest on this podcast and into my home office, freelance photojournalist and filmmaker Christy Frank. Christy has both an undergraduate degree in communication with a dual concentration in journalism and marketing and an MBA from the University of Toledo, so she knows of what she speaks. We will also talk about being a woman photojournalist in a man's world. I wasn't shocked when you told me that only 11% of photojournalists and 20% of filmmakers working today are women. That's like one in four. And you, my friend, are a rare bird.
You would think in 2023 that it would be closer to half female photojournalists.
But nope. You say you have some theories about that, so we are going to get into those theories, as well as your amazing work with the National Audubon Society, National Wildlife Magazine, and the African Wildlife Sanctuary, just to name a few. We will also promote your first short film, cutely called Pluverville, about the migration of Lake Erie piping plovers, which stars Nellie and Nish, a pair of lovebirds who are the first to nest in Ohio in 83 years. Thanks for joining me on the show, Christy.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. If you're a dedicated listener, you probably know I always start off this podcast with this question. Are you a Buckeye born and raised?
Yes, I was born and raised here. I did move away for a while and wander a bit before I ended up feeling my roots pulling me back.
I think the biggest issue facing our industry today is freelancing. It used to be that staff photojournalists bravely gave up a steady paycheck and healthcare to freelance. Because, you know, they made a name for themselves and developed a client list while on the job, they were able to branch off on their own to work for themselves. But unfortunately, that security blanket has been yanked off because of massive nationwide layoffs, resulting in a saturated market full of unemployed visual journalists who, for the most part, have little to no experience operating a business. But you, who were smart enough to earn an MBA, have always freelanced. From day one. Why is that? How did you do it?
That's a good question.
How do you do it?
So I started, when I went to school for journalism, I had always had a camera in my hand since I was a little kid. And I loved taking pictures for the art of it, which is what I thought. And when I went to school for journalism, my intention originally was to write. I didn't really think about the visual aspect of that when I was in school. I loved writing, and that's really the direction I thought I was going to go. And the more I experimented with visual storytelling, the more I realized I fell in love with that. Because of the way my personal life decided to unfold, I ended up seeking employment that was a more steady paycheck while I pursued visual storytelling on the side. And really, when I finished with my undergraduate degree, things were already starting to really look difficult in that industry, in that field. There were a lot of people I knew that were struggling to make ends meet that were working at local papers. I was constantly getting warned about local papers closing. So when you're someone that is trying to pay off student loan debt and trying to, you know, support themselves and their bills, entering a field knowing that there's no way you'd be able to pay your bills at that time was scary to me, especially because of where I was living. I was living in a city that had a very high cost of living. I realized that having a steady paycheck would give me the means to be able to pursue stories that I really cared about. And it would allow me to be able to afford the gear to travel, stuff like that, in my spare time. It wasn't necessarily ideal. It wasn't my dream, but it was a way that I could still stay in that passionate career that I really cared about without it necessarily, I wasn't dependent on it for a paycheck.
How were you introduced to visual storytelling? Did UT have any classes that introduced you to visual storytelling?
Not that I took, and I'm not sure if they were offered back when I was there. I actually lived in Florida for a while, and at Daytona State College, I took some photography courses down there. That was prior to my journalism degree. Like I said, I wandered the country for a while. I'm a little bit of a seeker and always trying to get some answers that are beyond me. So after that wandering, I ended up doing that journalism degree. I actually really didn't know the power of storytelling at first. It was always like this concept that I thought sounded really romantic or really powerful, but it was never something that felt within reach because of my economic circumstances. And it wasn't until I had this bit of a revelation in, I think it was about 2015 or 2016, when I decided that this was something that I had really always had buried in me, and I wanted to see if there was some way that I could pursue it, even though it wasn't necessarily my main career. And I felt really called to do that, and I found this opportunity to go to Sumatra and do a little bit of photojournalism there and work on a story that was really important to me because it tied in both people and the environment. And that, seeing the results of that, is what drew me in, and I dove in headfirst.
Where is Sumatra?
Sumatra's in Indonesia.
Okay. Yeah, you have a very fascinating eclectic resume. I have to say, when you told me about the jobs you currently have, I admit I was taken aback a little. I love how you put it. You said you have a job that pays the bills, a job that pays other people's bills, and then your side hustle. Can you share with our listeners what those jobs are?
So the job that pays my bills and allows me to pursue the stories that I really care about is actually in IT. So I run an IT department during the day. And luckily I'm really grateful to have that position because that's what's allowed me to pay my bills and be able to afford the things I need to be able to cover the stories that I wanted to cover. And then I also I'm the founder of a preschool locally, which is also a weird mix. I'm in a bit of an enigma.
And that's what pays other people's bills.
That pays other people's bills, and it provides a little bit of a service to the community. It's a nature-based preschool, and it's been rewarding in non-monetary ways. And then the side hustle that you mentioned, which is visual storytelling.
I asked you the other day if you had the choice which job you would prefer. Of course, you answered storytelling, which is more than a side hustle. It's your passion. What is it about storytelling that you fell in love with? I know you talked about it a little bit ago, but I think a lot of your freelancing has been with animals. Is that one of your passions, or do you tell other stories besides that?
I do tell other stories besides that. I think the ones that have been most widely published have been the ones involving wildlife and the environment. Those are really environmental stories and community stories, and humanitarian stories are my favorite. There, you can make such an impact with storytelling, and it's a way that you can help elevate other voices besides, I mean, it's really empowering. Storytelling is really empowering, not only for someone like me who was really learning how to even use my own voice back in 2015, 2016. But it's also a way to give empowerment to other voices, and by giving them a platform and helping to share their story, whether that's people or an environmental story that's affecting people and wildlife, it's all connected. So when I saw the impact that that could have from that very first leap that I made, it was really the impactful point that drove me to continue to pursue it.
I'm glad you did. I cannot wait to see your film, by the way. I bet those birds are cute as hell.
They are pretty cute.
You mentioned a conversation you had with a mentor a few years ago that everything you've been through in your life and the winding paths you've taken have given you a different, weird perspective on things. Can you elaborate on that?
I haven't taken a traditional path at all. I didn't I didn't go right from high school to college to a job. I went from high school to college and then dropped out of college a few times and then had a lot of personal life changes. And it took me a long time to really figure out who I was. In the meantime, this winding path, which I have a theory about it, I used to think that life was basically this map and I was trying to get from my starting point to my destination point, and there was this one path that I was supposed to be taking, this one trail, and that would be the correct path. And really, I heard something a few years ago that really it's more like a compass, and you have a compass and you can take a few steps at a time in a direction that feels right to you. So that's what I've been trying to live by for years now, is that I might not be able to see the whole direction, but I can take a few steps in what feels right. And so for me, I've had this strange perspective that ties in business. So I can see like an economic or a business side of a story, wildlife and environment, because I've got a bit of a background in biology. So I see that side of a story. The journalism side. So I've learned some of the basic journalism skills that are really important, especially when it comes to not being biased and stuff like that. Just the way I was raised and everything too has given me a bit of a different perspective. So when you take all of those things together, no matter what your background is, and this is good for anybody that's entering this, even if you're doing it like I am way later in life, that's okay, because you're bringing something unique to that table. And we need different voices. We need a variety of voices to all be sharing in this and be expressing what they see in our culture.
It's like that saying, if you want to change the story, change the storyteller.
I think that's important.
And for the past 70s and 80s, the storytellers have been men.
Well, and even today, like when we were talking, I was shocked when I was looking up these statistics, because, you know, it's one thing to always feel like you're very outnumbered. It's another thing when you look at the statistics and you realize that only 11% of photojournalists today are women. And I can't even imagine what it is for non-binary. And, you know, I'm sure that's the number's probably even lower. And when you look at that and you're like, 11% of the population, it should be closer to 50. So,
and imagine, and if you add women of color to that.
Right.
I mean, you're cutting that to a fraction.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of stories not being told.
Or even not being told from a perspective that might be really important that we're overlooking.
Let's get into filmmaking.
Okay.
Particularly your first short film, Pleverville. Can you tell us how you met Nellie and Nish and how it grew from a freelance story to a short film? In fact, you thought it was going to be this 5-minute reel you were going to just throw on Instagram, but it ended up being this huge dramatic story that's gotten into a couple film festivals and screenings. How does that happen?
This is one of those things where I guess that compass theory really applies, because if you would have told me that this is what was going to happen a year ago, I wouldn't have, well, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have believed you. But this also shows that when you have something that's failing miserably, that doesn't mean things won't turn around in a different direction. I was trying to film something else for a producer, and it was going terribly because what I was trying to film just wasn't cooperating. It was another wildlife thing. And I took a break at the beach at Maumee Bay State Park, and there were these two birds that I thought looked a little different. And I'm not a birder, so I didn't know what they were, but they were doing all this like weird dancing, and I thought, well, that seems important. Kind of looks like they might be trying to impress each other. So I took photos and I filmed it, which I don't know what made me that first day try to film that. I think I was just playing around, and I had been dabbling in that. I had only shot B-roll for other people at that point, but never really anything for myself. And I just, while I was out there, I just decided to have fun with it. And basically, as the story went on over the next few days, I learned about what they were. These people kept coming out to visit them and were so excited about the fact that these piping plovers were there at the beach. And I fell in love with the people just as much as the birds. And that's when I realized there's a big story here, because I learned about the fact that they hadn't nested in Ohio in over 83 years. And how normally freelancing works for me is basically you hope you know, you stay curious enough to find a story, and that's what happened. And I pitched it to Audubon and they picked it up. And it's a little unusual because a lot of times people that are photographers don't write the story as well, but because I have this strange background where I write and photograph, they offered to let me do both. And I did. And along the way, as I was working on that, I still kept filming. I don't know why. I just thought they were interesting. And I kept thinking that there's a bigger story here because of the people that were so excited. And they just, it was such a sense of community. And I don't know, halfway through the project, I realized there was really something here. I guess I thought, I wonder if I can make this into something bigger, because it had impacted me so much personally. It had impacted the people there so much that it felt like there was a bigger message that needed to get out.
How long did you work on that project?
So I started filming in May because of the circumstances and what happened with these birds there. One of the birds actually ended up being at the beach until October, which is very unusual, was not supposed to happen.
Just one of them?
Yes, because that one had some issues with its health in the end. So yeah, there's a whole very dramatic storyline with these sweet little birds. And so in October, I finished filming, and then my goal was to have a short film done by spring when migration happens in Ohio. And so I ended up contacting an editor that had just graduated with her MFA, and she was recommended to me, and her name's Grace Uggleston. She was amazing. It wouldn't have been the story that it was without her, and that's a real... Collaboration is so important. And because of that, we got this short film out, and it's impacted a lot of people.
Can you take us back to that night when Pluverville was being screened at the Mommy Indoor Theater? What was it like to be a star in your own hometown? And did you have a red carpet?
I did not. The first premiere was actually at Maumee Bay State Park. The second screening was at at the Maumee Theater. And both times that it screened, it was a little surreal to me because it was never something that I expected to happen. And I think the best part was seeing and hearing people react to different parts of the film, especially people that had been there and lived through that, or the people that take pride in this community that live here. I think people's reactions was the best. There's something really amazing being able, because normally, you know, if on a photojournalism project, you're lucky if someone even comments and says, hey, great story. You know, you don't normally get that kind of feedback. And in a situation like that, to have people giving you live feedback right in front of you, I guess it could be terrible if people hate it. But for me, having that live feedback right there where people, you know, you see people dabbing at their eyes with tissues, or you get to hear the whole audience erupt in laughter. And there's something amazing knowing that a team of you put something together that was actually touching people's hearts.
How can our listeners find Pluverville? Is it available on your website or online?
It will eventually be online. Right now, it's still in the film festival circuit. So if you go to Pluverville.com, you can see when the next screenings are coming up and follow along that way.
I really hope to be at the next one.
I hope you can make it.
Because I was out of town when you had the screening that I knew about was at the Maumee Indoor Theater.
Yeah.
You also have a traveling photo exhibition called The Forgotten Wolf, which was shown at the Toledo Lucas County Public Library. Can you tell us about that?
So that photo exhibit was a project that I worked on collaboratively with Running Wild Media, which is a company that's co-owned by Alex Goetz and Justin Grubb. They invited me along to help shoot B-roll and to take photographs on this project with the Red Wolf. And that's down in North Carolina where they're trying this reintroduction effort. And it was an incredible experience. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is trying really hard to save this endangered species. There's less than 20 left in the wild, and the efforts that they're going to reintroduce them and to save this species has been really, it's been a real challenge for a number of reasons. And this is another case too where these stories are really important so that people understand what's going on. It was a fantastic experience. We got to go down there twice for red wolf releases, where they take captive wolves and release them back into the wild. So that exhibit is actually has been in quite a few places now and will continue to be. And it's all in the hopes that it helps to educate members of the public so they understand why these red wolves are important, why predators are important in an ecosystem, what they can do to help try to save these wolves. You know, so it's really an outreach component with that. We also had a story in National Wildlife Federation magazine about that as well. And that's kind of one of those long ongoing projects.
You know, Alex is the cousin of one of my best friends. And he came over to my house a few months ago and wanted to wander my woods looking for owls and other critters that are back there. So, you know, his love of wildlife and is pretty impressive.
Yeah, he's been great to collaborate with. I really like working with him. He's a good friend.
Are you working on anything at the moment, or are you? Do you have something on the back burner that you're gonna do?
I do. I always have a list of.
There you go. What's on that list?
Well, I have a couple. Actually, I have a short film right now that Alex and I are finishing up. That was a personal project he and I took on, and we're really excited about that. That's another collaborative thing. I really enjoy collaborating with people. A lot of this industry tends to be very competitive, especially when you get into the environmental and wildlife side of things. It's so much fun when it's project where you're working with someone on a goal rather than just by yourself and competing with people. I've been told I need to be more competitive. It's just not who I am. So I'm excited about that. And that's my direction's really been incorporating more multimedia, and which I've gotten advice against that, but it's really what I love. I love multimedia. I love all of it. Any way that I can get a story out in the best way that will touch people's hearts, that will share something that needs to be said, I embrace all of it. And then I have a few still photo stories that I'm working on that are a little more locally focused, because I think backyard stories can be some of the most powerful ones as well. Mm-hmm. And there's usually a list of those that I'm kind of alternating. As a freelancer, I have the, you know, power to do that, where I can kind of take my time on a long form story and work on it as things happen.
You and I have bumped into each other quite a few times over the years, and it always amazed me that there are freelancers out there, because I come from a staff photography position where I didn't consider freelancing, never ever thought about it. And then I would bump into you. I'm like, who do you work for? He's like, nobody. Like, it's like, wow, how does that happen? How do you afford it? You know, what do you do? So it's a thrill for me to sit here and get your story. And I think it's going to be an interest for other people who are in your shoes.
Yeah, it's been fun to bump into you. And it's always something I cover everything. Like, I think that's something, especially for people that are new to that, just get out there and shoot, because it's never going to be a bad thing. And if anything, it makes you a stronger shooter. Even if the story goes nowhere, just working on something, even if you're just covering what you think might be the most mundane thing, you never know. It could be, you might catch a moment that is really important. And it's made me a stronger shooter, just going out and trying to cover things that are happening in the community.
Like the birds.
Like the birds. You never know what's going to happen. You could end up doing a whole short film.
What kind of equipment do you use? What do you have in your tool arsenal, camera bag?
It depends on where I'm going and what I'm primarily doing. And I've changed brands a few times. I usually, just to keep it a little generic, I guess, because I really don't think that at a certain point, let me start over. Because I used to hate when people were like, gear doesn't matter. It does a little bit.
Gear does matter. Yeah.
What I have in my camera bag any given day, it depends on what I'm shooting. It depends on if I'm hoping to do still photos, which is still that will always be my first love. Or if I'm hoping that I'll get really good audio or really good video. So I kind of adjust things based on that. I usually have at least two camera bodies, a DSLR and a mirrorless. I shoot video on the mirrorless. and a range of lenses. If I'm out shooting an environmental thing where I might need to get detailed wildlife at a distance, I will take a lens that's either a 400 or a 500 millimeter length with me. If I'm not shooting wildlife, then I usually stick to your normal, 70 to 200, 24 to 70, or some primes.
What's your brand? Before I retired, I bought Fujifilm X-H1s for the video aspect of it because it's stabilized in the body and the lenses. But at the blade, we used Canon. I'm really curious. What do you got?
Right now, I'm shooting Nikon. I shot Canon my whole life. I'm shooting Nikon right now. I've got some friends at Sony trying to get me to switch over to Sony. And when I shoot B-roll, I shoot whatever people want me to shoot. Sometimes they want me to stick with their brand so that the color profiles are all similar. A lot of times for that stuff, I'm shooting Sony. So I've had to learn other cameras.
Do you have to rent them then? Do you have to rent the Sony?
It depends. I either have to rent them or if they're shooting something and they, like the last thing I shot, someone had a Sony FX6 and I had to use that so that he could actually narrate. Because he wanted to be in front of the camera for that particular shoot. So I had to learn how to use an FX6 really quick. So I think as long as you know the basics and then make sure you learn the fine tunings of the camera that you're out in the field with that day, that's what's important.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that you know your camera controls. So, all the cameras are basically built the same. But if you know how to do everything on manual, your ISO, your shutter speed, your f-stop, and you know how to, the reciprocity thing.
I think the important thing is to know what your end goal is and be ready to change that if necessary. Be ready to adjust. So I never expected that because I had a mirrorless camera that was capable of shooting decent video that I would end up making a whole film. But luckily I had my DSLR and my mirrorless with me that day. And I tend to over-prepare, which I don't think is a bad thing. And because I had that capability, which it wasn't top of the line. You don't have to have top of the line gear to have quality thing. At the end of the day, the story is what matters. You just have to have gear that's actually capable of capturing it. So if you're interested in doing the more of the multimedia thing, invest in decent audio equipment. Invest in a decent mirrorless or one of the other cinema cameras that can do good video. And there's nothing wrong with using a trusty older DSLR for those still photos because they can still produce amazing still images.
And your phone. Let's finish off with some advice for our listeners who want to break into freelancing or maybe they're already freelancing. One piece of great advice I want you to talk about is being persistent and to learn how to fail over and over and over and to keep getting back up and to not give up no matter how many times you're told no. For example, your application to the Eddie Adams workshop was rejected like how many times?
Four.
Four times. And yet you persisted and were lucky enough to finally get accepted right before you aged out. What did you learn from that experience?
Well, I think in all of those experiences, repeatedly, I've learned that for every 99 no's, you'll get one yes. And that one yes is what matters. The 99 no's don't. And you can usually learn something from the no's. The thing that I've learned from that experience and from a lot of my experiences, because I've had a lot of no's and a lot of rejections, that's the foundation of freelancer life is most of the time your emails won't even get read. You'll pitch a story to 100 people and only one maybe you'll even read it. Because they're busy. Editors are busy. And I've learned, like you said, about the importance of being persistent, continuing to follow your passion. If your story doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't mean it wasn't valuable. It means you learned something and you can still do something with that story too. You can put it up on your website, whatever. You've learned something. You've grown as a freelancer from that story. And I have stories that have opened doors to me, to other people in the community that no one's ever seen the light of day of. But they led to some other story because I stayed curious. And I think that's probably one of the most important things. When you're working on something, keep an open mind and stay curious because what you think you might want to tell might not end up being the most important part that needs to get out there into the world. And I think it's really important to keep an open mind to that.
How do you think business plays into freelancing? How do you use your MBA in your storytelling business?
My MBA has taught me a couple of different things. No, not a couple, more than a couple. My MBA has given me a unique perspective in a variety of ways. One, it's taught me what people on the business side of things or people that are looking at economics, it shows me what their perspective on any story might tend to be when they're looking at the bottom line or where they're looking at why a corporation might be making a decision that they're making. When it comes to my own personal business, it's helped because of budgeting. That's really important as a freelancer. You have to be realistic about what you can afford, where you need to stop, where you maybe need to seek out other funding. It's made me a better writer. It's helped with applying for grants. It's helped me figure out how to market myself. My MBA's concentration, I was dual majored in marketing and information systems. So the marketing side of that has taught me how to market myself a little better. I'm actually better at marketing for other people than I am myself. But at the end of the day, it has made me stronger as far as being in business for myself. And that's really important if you want to be able to continue down this route.
Any other advice you'd like to share?
Oh, I have a couple of things.
Okay.
I made some notes because I was trying to think of, as a freelancer, what kind of things have been unique. I think I mentioned most of them because I'm trying to think here.
Yeah, I'm glad you made notes.
Yeah, there was a couple of things. Because I was thinking about what would I have wanted to hear back when I first started type of thing.
Exactly.
So advice that I would have for freelancers, especially new to this, I have a few things. One is to not be afraid to collaborate with people and reach out to collaborate with people. Even if you feel like you're working on the same story, I think that's actually benefited me more than it's ever hurt me. The other thing is to stay curious. I mentioned that already, but that has led me in directions and to stories that I would have never found otherwise. And this seems like an odd piece of advice, but also take breaks, especially if you work in environmental stories or humanitarian stories, because those can tend to be very heavy. And when you're covering that stuff after a while and you're really digging deep, especially if you're like me and you tend to love these long form stories, burnout is real. And especially when you're you're constantly pitching, you're getting rejected, you need to keep working on stories, you have limited funding because all of the costs are up front usually for most people that are freelancing. Even staff photographers that do these personal projects on their own, I mean, they face the same thing. A lot of these stories, I've talked to a lot of people that are very well-known staff photographers, but they have personal projects and they're self-funding those. Burnout is real and it's okay to take a break. It's okay to let yourself rest and recharge because you're going to come back a lot more powerful, recharged from a break than you are if you just keep burning yourself out. And even Jane Goodall, who we all know, she even talks about that when it comes to environmental work because it can tend to be so depressing after a while. And she talks about, that's one of the things in her book she talks about, which really helped me feel better about myself. If you're a freelancer, whatever stories you tend to cover, we are all working in this together. So when one person needs to take a break, another person can step up and carry that load for a while. And we're all better off for doing that together.
Well, thank you, Christy Frank, for joining me on the Buckeye Visualist podcast. I'm so proud of you for all you've accomplished on your own and to not let failure stop you from your passion of storytelling. I hope you have many more years of filmmaking to come. You can view Christy's work on her website at christyfrank.com. That's christyfrank.com. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Buckeye Visualist. This is your host, Lori King, signing off. Keep an F2.8 mind, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Buckeye Visualist and ONPA Production.